Okay, so to get started, today's class we are going over spiritual alchemy. In class two, we will talk about laboratory alchemy, focusing mostly on spagyrics and plant alchemy, and maybe talk a little bit about the Philosopher's Stone, but maybe not. And then in the third class, we will be talking about applications of alchemical ideas and processes to life and to other spirituality and magic. So this class, while it should have a good bit of info, will probably be the kind of lightest class in a certain sense. And then the next class will give a lot more in-depth, detailed technical material. And then the third class will be ways that you can apply that even without necessarily having to go build a lab in your backyard, which soon I should be doing.
When it comes to alchemy.
I have some laboratory equipment. We've made our own absinthe.
I'm buying a whole extra shed in order to build a lab for vinting and alchemy. Yes.
Okay, Jack Parsons.
Yes. Oh, I just got a beta fish yesterday, and his name is Parsons now. So. So, alchemy is a word that draws a myriad of images from people when it's said. Now, amongst a group like this, you're probably going to have pretty okay like images pop to mind when people say alchemy. But if you talk to the average person on the street, if they have any idea of what alchemy is at all, then they're going to think of things like fantastic fantasy images of medieval or Renaissance sorcerers brewing up weird potions and explosives in laboratories. Or they might think of anime characters clapping their hands together and changing matter and going off fighting corrupt states. They might think of crackpot early scientists who believed bizarre things about transmuting base metals into gold and other superior metals. Or they might think of snake oil salesmen and other charlatans going out and peddling fake medicines to people who didn't know any better because they didn't have real science. And all of these ideas are kind of based on the idea that people living before the modern age were either idiots or crazy. That's true. Most people today are either idiots or crazy. But there's this idea that it didn't matter what people came up and tried to tell you they were doing, that back then people would just believe anything. Now, if you have people who have a little bit more of an educated view, they might be a little bit more sympathetic to the idea of alchemists. They might just think of them as early scientists who are a little bit misguided, who took elements of Greek philosophy that was resurging in the Renaissance and just took the ideas a little bit too far, where they had the base ideas of science but didn't quite have enough knowledge in order to take it in a direction that was really going to be scientific. But again, that is still kind of assuming an essential failure as opposed to a clear development in that case, or assuming that this is still something that's lesser, that wasn't its own complete thing that could have been viable. If you look at the reality of alchemy, you'll find that the people that were involved in it, many of them were early scientists, but they were certainly not people that we would tend to think of as misguided today, the exception of Francis Bacon. A lot of them were people who created the foundations of a lot of modern science, and they did their alchemy as something that went along with the science they were doing. They weren't necessarily the same thing. In some ways, they were connected, because in some fields like metallurgy, there wasn't really a lot of room for a split between what the alchemists were doing and what metallurgists were doing. But there was still something more to it than just a precursor of science. And if you look at the nature of the word alchemy, and there's some debate as to what the word means or where it came from. One of the views is that it's divine chemistry, that it is this idea of a chemistry based on God and on a connection to the divinity within nature and within the materials being worked. And that somehow seeking God through these chemical processes is a way in which the alchemist, the divine, and the natural material all join together in this kind of divine link. And that gives you a much more illustrative idea of what alchemy was to the early alchemists and what alchemy is today also. It's kind of a meeting place of piety and science, where you have this view that the world is not simply the matter that's right there in front of you, and that that matter is just dead material that you pick up, move around, carve into things, and put places. It takes much more of the Platonic ideal into play, the ideal that there's some more perfect reality or more perfect concept behind things, and that we can approach that through understanding and manipulating the material in certain ways. It takes on the idea that through this understanding that man is able to understand the ultimate creator of all of the material that's being worked with in alchemy, which is also therefore the creator of man, and that man is able to take part in that creation and that work and therefore understand within himself that same divine element and that same ability to function as the prime mover. It explores the idea that science and religion are in many ways one pursuit. Both are ways of knowing the world, just different parts of the world, and exploring ways to deepen and systematize that knowledge and to explain experience in a more complete way so that that knowledge can be applied, but also so that the experience can be enriched and man can gain more from his experience of the world than just walking through and feeling the dirt beneath his feet and letting the rain fall upon him, that he'll understand more about what's going on with all the phenomena that he encounters. It's very much the idea which was expressed, I believe, by Feynman, that science and having an understanding of the physical nature of things makes it much more fulfilling when you experience them. When asked if understanding physics and mathematics and the chemistry behind an experience like smelling a rose took away from that experience by making it less of an artful, poetic thing, he replied that it actually made this experience much more fulfilling and enriching because he understood every part of the experience and was able to put it together in a much greater sense in his mind. Excuse me. And this is very much the idea that's in place within alchemy, that you're understanding not simply the physical and scientific components of a thing, but also the internal and spiritual components of the thing and how those two line up together and explain each other in a greater fashion, how they interact, so that you have a much deeper experience of the whole. And if we look at many of the famous historical participants in alchemy, we can see that this was very much the case for them. And not only do we see that this was the case, but we see that the point clearly was this idea that science and religion had to work in tandem with one another. That in order to really progress in science, there had to be a religious basis because the methods that were allowable to scientists could only take one so far, and that eventually knowledge had to come from recourse to basically asking God and exploring the heavens. And even in modern science, we see echoes of this as we look at cosmological studies, where scientists begin to explore things that are able to be conceptualized within theory and through mathematics, but where there are limits to the experimental capabilities of science. And these things begin to start looking fuzzy, to the point where they stop fitting into what the average person on the street would say even makes logical sense or fits their experience, but they start dealing with things that are so conceptual and so bizarre that it begins to cease looking like science and begin looking like religion.
Like math.
Yes.
Which but.
There definitely are very clear overlaps between math and magic and religion. But if you look at people like John Dee, who isn't really known for his alchemy so much as his contributions to angel magic, but he was involved with alchemy, and his assistant Edward Kelly was said to have discovered the Philosopher's Stone at one point. He's still remembered as being the most intelligent man of his era. And he invented.
He
was, and he invented Greenwich Mean Time. Like, there are so many things in just kind of base use at this point that can trace themselves back to John Dee, even outside of magic. Isaac Newton was described by John Maynard Keynes as not being the first scientist, but being the last magician, because he spent more of his time on alchemy and on religious pursuits than he did on his scientific pursuits. If you look at the writings of Newton, they form huge volumes, but the vast majority of them are about ontology and religion and come from an alchemical perspective. He was so involved with his alchemy that he almost lost his professorship because they felt that his alchemy made him some kind of quack or nut job, but because they feared for his health with the experiments that he was doing, and they feared that he would create more explosions on campus.
I had a chemistry professor like that.
Yes. But, I mean, the list goes on and on. You have Francis Bacon, Roger Bacon, Tycho Brahe. I'm not sure that he was ever an alchemist, but he was an astrologer and has been linked to the Rosicrucian movement, so was quite possibly involved in alchemy as well. George Starkey, who most people involved in the occult know as Philalethes, was a teacher of Newton and also of Boyle, who was one of the major founders of chemistry. And he was known specifically for being an alchemist. When he moved to England to be a doctor, he became a famous and successful doctor because of his reputation as an alchemist. So, so many of our fundamental figures in science, of course, the most important being Paracelsus, who redefined alchemy, but also redefined medicine. And a lot of people, even a lot of occultists and sympathizers, don't realize this. But contemporary medical thought is based on Paracelsian thought. Up until Paracelsus, the prevailing medical view was still the Greek view of Galen, where medicine is based on the four humors. And it's kind of interesting that Paracelsus moved away from the four humors and therefore moved medicine away from a system based on the four elements, because Paracelsus was also the alchemist that moved alchemy away from being based on the four elements and towards being based on the three principles. But in Paracelsian medicine, the idea was that a disease or a series of symptoms could be isolated as being related to a given cause, and that medicine had to treat that cause. And so various plants and materials that could be found had essential properties that would affect other causes within the body and would be corrective for the causes that created symptoms of disease, which is basically how medicine works today. And if you look at the history of modern medicine, Paracelsus is still credited with that development. A person who could be argued as one of the greatest of the historical alchemists is also basically the founder of modern medicine. Even outside of the realm of science, if you look at St. Thomas Aquinas, one of the greatest thinkers in theology, he has a section of the Summa Theologica which deals with the practice of alchemy and explains the good religious and moral implications of alchemical practice. He also had a separate paper which he wrote outside of the Summa, which dealt with this topic, as did the Pope, who is a contemporary of St. Thomas Aquinas. And if you...
What was that?
Oh, I can't remember. there, it's, if you look in the Catholic Encyclopedia, it notes it, because there were a couple popes that overlapped with St. Thomas Aquinas. But the, in his view, and in the Pope's view at the time, it was important to distinguish between true alchemists, who were alchemists that engaged in their alchemy for spiritual and religious pursuits, from charcoal burners, or alchemists who believed that they could physically turn lead into gold, and that that was the sole purpose of their alchemical work. But in addition to his works specifically on alchemy, his work of Essence and Being, which is the fundamental work on Eucharistic theology in the Catholic Church, is essentially an alchemical text, and basically explains the process of Eucharistic transubstantiation through the theories of alchemical transmutation, explaining how each of these work. The text could be taken either as a text for explaining alchemy to the new alchemist, or explaining transubstantiation to the new priest. Within the modern era, our famous alchemists have also primarily been scientists. If you look at Frater Albertus, whose work, A Handbook of Laboratory Alchemy, or An Alchemist's Handbook, has been the most popular book on laboratory alchemy for probably the past 30 or 40 years. He was a doctor of pharmacology and worked in the pharmaceuticals field. He also basically started a college for alchemists where people would go for several months out of the year and take alchemical training. And he had a company for a while that was looking at commercial means of alchemical production. Practical Plant Alchemy, which is by, and I always mess up his name, Manfred Junius. He was also a scientist. He was a doctor of biology and had a focus, I believe, in botany. And so his book was, with Albertus's book, the other principal book on modern laboratory alchemy for years. There's been a resurgence recently with new books coming out. But even amongst those, one of the early ones was by Leswicki, and he was a doctor of physics. Israel Regardi, doctor chiropractic and a psychotherapist, also wrote about alchemy and eventually came around to the laboratory view as opposed to just the spiritual view of alchemy. So it's a field that even amongst contemporary magicians and occultists has been dominated by scientists. You'll note Crowley never really wrote a book on alchemy. Mathers was a mortician, so I guess he had a science background. And so he wrote some alchemical work for the Golden Dawn, but didn't really focus himself on alchemy. that might have been Westcott. Excuse me. But it's always been something that's been dominated by people of a scientific mind and with scientific training. So the idea that even in the modern day, alchemy is something that can be taken seriously by people with a real scientific background is something that's very well evidenced by those who've been involved with it. If you look at a handful of universities today, there is alchemical research being done at some of them. There's at least one in England and one, if not two, in the United States where there are professors who are doing research in laboratory alchemy based on Newton's writings, and they are working through science departments. So it's not something that's being done through history departments or religion departments, but by scientists. So this idea that alchemy is all fantasy or all New Age thought is patently ridiculous. The history of the people who've been involved with alchemy attests to the fact that it's something that has a serious basis within serious scientific processes. So, the alchemical apology being over, we should probably actually look at what alchemy is as opposed to just who did it. With the base concept of alchemy, we have this idea of improving upon nature through the methods of nature. So it's significantly less supernatural than what a lot of people would assume most forms of magic and occultism are. It's not this idea that you're going to conjure angels or you're going to say archaic words or draw strange symbols and suddenly magical things are going to be happening and things are going to be transmuted from one substance to another. There's very much an idea that through studying natural processes and applying them in a controlled laboratory fashion, we are able to improve upon those processes and create things which improve upon the natural state of a thing. Now, again, this gets into where alchemy and chemistry line up to some degree, that in chemistry, you're dealing with reactions that are based on natural processes, but are occurring in a controlled setting based on catalysts that scientists are putting in place. This is the same idea in alchemy, but in alchemy, there is more of a view of understanding nature as nature, not simply understanding nature as a series of distinct processes which we can isolate and define and calculate and then simulate. In alchemy, there's more of an effort to look at nature as a thing itself and look at the collective underlying basis of nature and how everything that the alchemist works with is tied together through that basis, how there's a fundamental consistency or a fundamental essence to reality, and that through looking at that essence and looking at how there's an interplay of the different forces and influences upon a given manifestation, that we are able to explore how we can break down different pieces of that into individual components and then bring about the essential nature of the thing in order to apply that essential nature to another nature or another thing which is devoid of a nature, and then redefine that other substance into a new greater substance through this combination. And that gets into a little bit of the idea of what the Philosopher's Stone and the Elixir of Life are. But I think we would be kind of jumping the gun and putting the cart before the horse if we got into those at this point. Maybe at the end we'll talk about those a little bit, or maybe save them for one of the other classes. But it does also bring us to the idea of the relationship between alchemy and tradition. During the early to mid part of the 20th century, a lot of the resurgence in alchemical thinking was based very much in spiritual alchemy and alchemical symbolism, more than it was laboratory alchemy. Now, a lot of this was going on in continental Europe, and some of the major resurgences in laboratory alchemy at the time were also going on in continental Europe, particularly in France. So there was probably some overlap between these groups that were interested in it in a symbolic sense and those interested in it in a laboratory sense. But those who were interested in a symbolic sense, almost as a rule, were people who were connected to the traditionalist movement. So you'd be looking at people like René Guénon, Julius Evola, Ercole Quadrelli, and a host of other thinkers who were connected to traditionalism. Traditionalism being a political and philosophical movement that was a breakaway from fascism, that felt that fascism was a failure in its execution, but that the idea, if taken back to a more spiritual base, was the basis of how society should be run. And in the traditionalist view, the most important element is that there is a primordial truth, and that this primordial truth is essentially objective, but that the experience and nature of that truth is going to be subjective. It's basically like you could conceptualize it as there's a well, and in that well there's water, and it's true that there's water in the well. but each person can draw out a bit of that water, and the bit of the water that they're drawing out is going to be a little bit different and experienced differently by them. But it's all still that same water from that same well. It still all has the same basic source. So to the traditionalists, all religion, all philosophy has truth to it so long as it's tied to this primordial truth. And within the political sphere, the idea was that leaders need to be tied back to this current of primordial truth, and so they need a strong spiritual basis, which gives them the ability to function as leaders. And this idea goes back to kind of the core idea of alchemy, that the ability to create something that's going to be more fit, or something that's going to be more complete, or more correct, is based on going back to this initial primordial essence, that you're breaking down all of the appearances of the thing, all of the associations of the thing, all of the uses that have been attached to it but aren't actually the thing itself, and all of the material that's collected to it, all of the essentially filth or garbage that's grown up around it, and removing that so that you have the pure essence of the thing. And that pure essence is the piece of the primordial truth that is connected to that given manifestation. And so that's part of where you have this link between the traditionalist movement and alchemy. Another element of it, and this gets into the idea of the concept of the heroic juxtaposed to the concept of the incorruptible. In the traditionalist movement, the idea is that throughout history there have been heroes, and these heroes are connected to the primordial truth, and that's what galvanizes and strengthens them and allows them to act in a heroic manner, because they're being guided by their essential nature and the way in which that essential nature flows from the primordial truth. They are in touch with their incorruptible being, essentially. And in alchemy, that's what you're discovering through all of the degradation and disintegration of things. You're removing everything until you reach the incorruptible element of the thing. Gold is the central alchemical metal because of its ability to withstand decay, that it can be exposed to all sorts of processes and retain its integrity. And so essentially, the heroic concept is finding the alchemical gold within the self, which we'll get very much into what we will be talking about in the third class, because that's a lot of how alchemy ends up applying to initiation and magical processes and just life itself outside of a laboratory context. But it's also kind of the goal of the laboratory context of alchemy, that you are engaging in this laboratory context in order to not simply find the golden essence of the thing with which you're working, but also that essence within yourself through engaging the processes within your being while observing the processes external to yourself. And sort of part of this process of ingraining the observed process into yourself gets into the connection between alchemy and symbolism, which is also a large element of the connection between alchemy and the traditionalist movement, is that within the traditionalist movement, symbols speak to the primordial truth. They're a way in which man is able to engage the truth through observing something which is not the truth itself, but which echoes and speaks to some element of the nature of the truth. In our own experience, in the Gnostic Mass, when the lance is dipped into the cup, it's not, the moment isn't about the lance entering the cup, it's about everything that's symbolized by that moment. And if one is engaging the Mass actively and experiencing that moment within themselves, then they are creating the miracle of the Mass, or creating the Eucharist within their own being through the observation of that symbol and the internalization of that symbol. And this is one of the essential practices or processes within any religious or spiritual movement that's engaged in any kind of mystical element, or any kind of element in which the participant is engaging in some sort of direct communication with what's happening. And it's basically using that symbol to experience truth, or as they get into, in at least the film version of V for Vendetta, exposing the truth through lies. It's the work of the artist, basically. And this is part of what the traditionalists find as useful in alchemy. One of the associations that many people may have with alchemy are these elaborate iconographic pictures, where you have a series of scenes that depict these bizarre interactions of men and animals and planetary figures and all of these things that just wouldn't naturally go together, but are being placed together in these pictures. And what the picture is doing is it's collecting a series of symbols, so that through reflection upon those symbols, one who is initiated into the meaning of the symbols can understand what's being said about the alchemical process through the observation thereof. It's in part a way of communicating a message without having to write the message out in a way that everyone can read, but it's also a way of communicating the message where the message can be understood through a process of meditation upon the symbols in the picture, and engaging the picture in a spiritual sense or reflective, contemplative sense, as opposed to simply looking at it in an analytical sense. If anyone has seen Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, they have kind of a nice depiction of this in that film, where Sean Connery's character has a practice of taking illuminated images from the histories of Catholic art and redrawing them himself as a way of contemplating upon the meaning of the symbols and the spirituality and faith that inspired the original artist to create the image in the first place. It echoes this idea that a symbol can be a road back to truth through that process of inspiration, and that you don't have to be the one who's initially inspired to create the symbol, but you can still engage the symbol and ride that inspiration back towards that initial truth. And so much of alchemy is discussed through symbols. Alchemists will talk about all sorts of concepts in symbolic language, and it's often been suggested that the reason for doing this was to veil and hide the truth of alchemical processes, and to some degree it was, and still is. But part of it is also a means of exposing that truth by making it clearer to one who's able to understand it. And this is something that you will frequently see the alchemists point out when they talk about their work. They will say that they haven't put anything that is untrue in their writings, or they haven't put anything in the writing that a person uninitiated into alchemy could understand, but then they will say that everything that they've put in there is to be understood clearly the way that it's written, and not something that needs to be decoded thoroughly. And at first glance, some of these comments, which will appear within the same texts at times, would seem to be contradictory, until you take the idea that these symbols mask what's being talked about to those who don't understand them, but to those who do, they elucidate a meaning beyond simply the analytical explanation of the text. And that gets to an important note on kind of the nature of symbolism and how that's discussed in a modern context versus how it's discussed in a traditional context. A lot of times you'll hear people throw out the line, "The map is not the territory." And I want to vomit when people say that. Because one, it's just overused, and two, it's not really true when we're talking about magical and alchemical work. Yes.
I don't expect people, because they always say it in a superior way, and I never have any clue what it means to start with. So I just figure they're trying to make me feel inferior, so I want to keep them in the cap.
Well, that's
a good response. The place where you see it a lot these days is in discussing the Kabbalah, and it seems to to be this idea that you're telling people, no, if you look up in the heavens, there's not really a big tree of life that you're going to climb that looks like a series of straws and grapes. Like,
I don't know that.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, if you watch Evangelion, obviously there's a big tree of life above the earth.
Yeah, just like that.
But what it's missing is this idea that you have the physical interpretation of reality, where you're able to view things based on what is physically observable. And then there's an internal interpretation or view of reality, which deals with things on a fundamental nature and a metaphysical nature that is beyond what is purely observable. And that the nature of this unobservable level of reality is somewhat incomprehensible in normal consciousness. And so it can only be discussed based on symbols. And this sounds very Jungian, but I really don't intend it to be. Because the symbols are not simply contrived or arbitrary archetypes. The symbols are actually communicating something about the nature of what is. So the tree of life can be depicted in many different ways and arranged in many different ways. But the fundamental nature of the system of the symbol is what's true and what exists. It's not something where you have to view it as, okay, this is clearly arrayed in this fashion with these spheres placed here and these paths between the spheres. But the idea of wells and flows of force and being is one that can be conceptualized as being essentially true. And you can look at the nature of the world around us and recognize this sort of underlying nature as the basis for the physically perceived nature. And that's what you kind of get into when you start recognizing the map and the territory as being the same thing. That it's not to say that in symbolic language the sun and gold and the soul are all one unit, so much as that they express something about each other that allows you to understand each more fully. But it is to say that the essential nature, in an interior sense, the essential fundamental divine metaphysical concept, which manifests itself as the sun and manifests itself as gold and manifests itself as the soul, are all stemming from the same essence. And that essence is manifesting in a different way based on different contexts for its manifestation and different factors that are interplaying with that manifestation. So that essence doesn't have to manifest simply in one manner, but will manifest differently as it interacts with other essences.
That was awesome. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
That really thumped some stuff home for me.
And that's really kind of the core of how alchemy works in the sense of the process of creation and the nature of being. That you're essentially dealing with these fundamental concepts or these perfect forms that are interacting in different ways. In Kabbalistic language, it's the world of Atzilut, the initial fiery world where the sparks of creation begin and are undefined and unseparated. Any given concept or action is still unified before it takes on all sorts of other principles as it moves through the world of association and formation and then eventually manifestation. Sendivogius describes this very beautifully in a piece where he talks about the impact of the stars on the creation of the metals, and that essentially starlight draws moisture from the earth, and the ways in which that moisture is drawn by the starlight through different parts of the earth results in the formation of the different metals. So essentially, each of the metals is a manifestation of starlight, the way in which the starlight is reflected within the moisture within the earth, and that starlight is drawn back towards its original source. But the way in which it attempts to get to that original source determines the way in which it manifests itself in a perceivable fashion. And so if it goes through one part of the earth or another part of the earth or another part of the earth, it takes on the features and elements of that part of the earth. Within our own lives, we can look at that in the sense that an infant is born into a given family or a given environment. And all of the features that are built into the conditions of his physical birth and the essential genetics that are forming his body are going to impact the way in which he develops. The modes and beliefs and views of his parents, his socioeconomic position, his neighborhood, his township, his country, all of those are going to define elements of the way in which he grows up and is built into a given person. But if you were to take that same infant and start him off in another context, then all of these different factors would be different for him. And there'd be certain elements that would be the same because you'd still have that same core essence, but the way in which that core essence would find its root of manifesting and the way in which it manifests through the world would be different because of all the different factors that are at play in that development. So this concept of the essence and the development of the essence into a given individual manifestation is something that we can see in a very real world context as well. It's not something that is only within sort of the intellectualization of alchemy. In seeking after that essence, one of the core ideas of alchemy is that when you break something apart or destroy something, each time it goes through this process, it gets closer and closer to the incorruptible or that which cannot be destroyed. And that essentially you're breaking apart and destroying all of the pieces which are imperfect and which are not eternal. And that the more of those you break away, the things that you're left with are subsequently the stronger and stronger pieces until you get to that fundamental eternal element of the thing. It basically, I mean, in a thermodynamic sense, yes. The tendency of the world of the universe towards entropy becomes one in which you can view the world as tending towards perfection by destroying everything which is capable of being destroyed. It's sort of Nietzschean in a sense, with his popular quotation of that which does not kill me makes me stronger, suggesting that in the process of going through trials and tribulations, you're destroying everything that couldn't survive those trials and tribulations, leaving you only with what's left. I mean, if we look in modern medicine, this has been the major problem with antibiotics. And some people accuse it of being a problem that hand sanitizer is going to exacerbate, that when people don't take their antibiotics fully, what survives are the strongest of the strains that are infecting them. And so the strongest continue multiplying, and we have these super strains of illness. With Germex killing 99.99% of germs, that 0.01% is the strongest portion of what's left in germs, and so that's what's left to multiply. So again, this concept is one that can be taken in a very real world sense. If you look at alchemy, most of the processes in alchemy are pretty destructive and kind of disgusting when you think about them initially. One of my favorite, in terms of just the way in which it's referred to and the imagery it creates in my mind, is putrefaction, the process of making something putrid. The even fermentation, which a lot of people think of more positively within the you basically are just making something rot. A lot of the alchemical processes are about rotting things. Calcination, which is one of the most fundamental processes, is one in which you burn things down to ash. And you can either have an open calcination or a closed calcination. Nia did not know about closed calcination when she taught me the alchemy lesson.
I was wondering that, the whole the red cat or the red heifer.
Yes. Well, I asked if the idea of the black work was that you hermetically sealed yourself for the process of calcination. And she said, no, you can't have calcination in a closed system. Yes, you can. In fact, they make calcination chambers in laboratory alchemy equipment.
That's interesting, because I don't think Michael thought that way.
Yeah, it's... But the idea of...
I've been trying to explain the putrefaction when I very first started, and I was like, I'm being putrefied? Like, yes.
It's a good thing.
You are.
Actually,
it's a good thing.
In the long-term way, we all are.
Mm-hmm. But with calcination... it's probably one of the most beautiful of the destructive methods of alchemy, at first glance at least, because you have this idea that regardless of whether it's an open or closed system, you are applying heat and fire to something, and that this fire is purifying, much like the purifying fire of the Kabbalah, and that its power to purify is that it's going to burn away everything that isn't real or true. And in plant alchemy, when you do this, it results in a white ash. And that white ash has salts in it, which you are then able to separate out. And those salts are what are used in the rest of the plant alchemy process. But you're basically taking this plant and burning it down to this pure white substance that has this very kind of driven, clean look and sense about it. And so even though you're being destructive, it results in something that kind of fits the common stereotype of something pure and holy and good in the end. And that kind of gets to the juxtaposition of degeneration and purification in alchemy. In magic and in occultism, something that's often glossed over is the fact that creation and destruction are equivalent processes. Any act of creation is by nature an act of destruction, just as any act of destruction is by nature an act of creation. In the end, the two are inseparable, and any distinction between them eventually becomes meaningless. Alchemy addresses this much more clearly and consistently than most magic does. Most magicians are kind of afraid of that concept. And in alchemy, you have this whole system where, in order to purify anything, in order to make anything better than what it is, or make it what it's supposed to be, you have to destroy it through processes of degeneration. You have to engage in these processes of decay and death and these interactions, which can be kind of disgusting as you observe them, in order to create the better thing that it is that you're trying to create. So it forces this juxtaposition of these concepts, which we would typically think of as bad and base, with these concepts that we would think of as holy and good. And
I took way too much biology to be grossed out that much.
The early alchemists didn't have that luxury. No. They just got to walk through the street and be grossed out by things.
Yes.
So, but in a sense, it's not simply, not even in a sense, just in for what it is. It's not just about getting rid of baggage and hang-ups around the concepts of death and decay. It's forcing one to understand that these processes are necessary, but not simply that they're necessary, but that they reveal a greater truth and reveal a greater whole, and that no one can engage in the perfection of the self or the perfection of anything else without the destruction of those elements which are the weaker elements that hold the thing back. And having this as a fundamental element of the ability to approach alchemy is important, because a lot of alchemy is about the mitigation of opposition. Now that's something that we do see in contemporary magic, but it's really a focus of when you're getting to higher levels of things, this idea of mitigating opposition and then eventually dissolving it. But it's very much a core element of alchemy that you have these somewhat opposing symbols or opposing natures, and that you can't have a manifestation until you combine these opposing natures and have them exist in a balanced form. You take things which are volatile and unfixed and you use them to fix each other into a set being or a set manifestation. So this concept of juxtaposing and uniting things which are disparate is essential to the alchemical process as well. Now, as kind of a way of moving more directly into alchemical symbolism, but also jumping off of this idea of juxtaposition, we will take a little winding detour down the road of heliocentricity versus geocentricity. And this is largely because an alchemical, modern, well, not really modern, he'd probably hit me if I called him modern if he were still living, but a almost contemporary alchemical writer, he has this little tirade in one section of his book, Alchemy, Science of the Cosmos, Science of the Soul, in which he goes on and on about the horrible world that we now live in, where the heliocentric view of the universe has taken over as an absolute view of the way in which the universe exists, and that it's relegated mankind to being these meaningless specks of dust, and that scientists ignore all of the spiritual and sacred components of the idea of a worldview. And it's very much about the idea of a traditional perspective versus a scientific perspective, with geocentricity clearly being the traditional perspective and heliocentricity clearly being the scientific perspective. Now, before we get any further, everyone does know and accept that we do live in a heliocentric solar system, right?
Like, no, the world is flat, too.
Yes, okay. Now, he's not trying to argue that we don't. He's trying to argue the value of having a worldview that's based on that.
Well, if you go out beyond the solar system, we almost have to come back to a geocentric view, because there's nowhere else to base.
Base it on black holes.
Well, most people are self-centered, so, you know.
Oh, and that's where the beauty of the heliocentric worldview comes into play. So, basically, the idea that in this argument between having a traditional perspective versus a scientific perspective is that the traditional perspective is inspired and the scientific perspective is reasoned. So you can have an inspired heliocentric worldview, and there were inspired heliocentric worldviews before it became the scientific worldview. Further, it's suggested that a traditional perspective is exalting, whereas a scientific perspective is more grounding, that through looking at an inspired or a traditional perspective, we learn things about man and the universe that cause man to recognize his own divinity or the glory of the soul or the road back to Jesus Christ or whatever the particular author wants us to understand. Whereas if we simply look at science, it tells us how dead and empty the world is, and how we're cut off from everything, and nothing we do is important, and that we're not the center of anything, and God's not watching us, and nothing matters. And those are pretty extreme views. And it's almost kind of getting into that whole idea of science saying, we can't accept religion because religion is baseless and idiotic and there's no room for religion in science, except in this case it's religion saying there's no room for science and religion, and religion is just awful and makes us think that science is just awful and tells us we shouldn't have religion. And what Burkert, who wrote the book that I'm referencing, tries to get at to some degree is that there's not really a need for this, that you can have a scientific perspective and a spiritual perspective that work together, and by approaching it in that manner, you can have multiple perspectives on the truth, which symbolize the truth in different ways. That it doesn't really matter that the Earth is revolving around the sun in a physical sense, because we can look at the symbols that are allowed by looking at the sun, the planets revolving around the Earth, and we can look at the symbols that are allowed by looking at the Earth and the planets revolving around the sun. And each method describes something different and important about what the fundamental truth is. So the fundamental truth behind the manifestation and behind the experience is more important than the actual mechanics of the manifestation. Now this, of course, gets into what exactly you're dealing with. If you are planning a space flight, you damn well better be using a heliocentric model of our solar system. Or you're... Yes, because things will just not work out very well otherwise. But if you're trying to understand man's place in the universe and understand how the universe functions on a divine level, then there are truths that can be explored through either of those models, and that by approaching both models, we can get at something that's much deeper and explains things much further. And this is kind of getting into the idea of sort of a traditional awareness, and then getting back to that idea of alchemy as a means of using scientific and physical processes as a way of exploring non-physical realities and exploring the divine nature of things. That we're able to accept that, yes, we have this perceived observable reality, but that we're also able to accept that there's truth beyond that, which explores the greater essence of our beings and the greater essence of our universe. In terms of that symbolism, with a geocentric model, we essentially look at a process in which the Earth is the slowest moving or the final process within manifestation. So it's the furthest away from God, the furthest away from the divine. And that it's where everything is basically locked in and fixed. And as you move through the planets and or the elements, and then the planets and the fixed stars and the firmament, you get closer and closer to the original motion. And that this motion basically spirals down and slows as it spirals down, taking on more and more elements, each element containing, or each level containing the elements of the last element, until everything is finally put together in this final result that in its weight of its collective nature holds together everything in this slow manifest physical being, which is the Earth. And so the process of initiation is essentially unfolding that spiral and moving back so that you take off more and more of those features that have weighted down being into its earthen manifestation, and move closer out to the firmament, and eventually through the firmament into the greater divine reality. In a heliocentric model, you are essentially looking at the concept of the soul or God as the center of reality, and that radiance is what gives light and life to the rest of the universe. And you still have this same process of spiraling out from that center with the Earth at the outer edge, but that everything is drawn together and created based on that guiding light, and so that light becomes the guiding principle back to the center. So they essentially are the same concept, just two ways of looking at it, sort of the heads and tails of the coin. Now, one of the complaints that Burkhardt makes about the scientific view of the heliocentric model is that science, as I mentioned earlier, tries to make man into specks of dust that are meaningless and strewn throughout the universe. And that there are many planets and many stars, and there are so many that none of it matters, because we're all just these tiny little insignificant pieces of creation, almost to the point where there is no creation, there's just stuff. And what he misses is the beauty of that model. In all of his complaining about having an absolute model and looking at the deeper meaning of a model, he misses the deeper meaning of the model that he's complaining about. That if the universe is essentially infinite, and everything in the universe is a meaningless speck of dust. Everything in the universe is the center of the universe, because each individual point is essentially equal to any other given point, and it's all a series of points within the infinite. And this kind of gets into the bridge between George Starkey, or Philalethes's, influence that led from alchemy to chemistry. Part of his view in alchemy was that processes occur because there are small, imperceivable particles that interact with one another in order to create these things that we have as observable chemical manifestations. And so he was taking things down to intending it on a chemical or molecular level. But then, of course, as chemistry developed, we had chemists and then again physicists taking it down to smaller and smaller particular levels. And so this worldview in which we're all basically just particles strewn throughout the universe, it's taking it into a worldview that is very much recognizing that the universe is just a series of particles that all interact with each other in different ways and create all the different manifestations and observations that we have, but that each particle is in essence infinite and composed of infinite particles, that there ends up being on some level no difference between the base units of things, going back almost towards Democritus and the original concept of the atom. And so it's a way that even this very dead view of the universe can be an exalting view by recognizing the glory of the infinite nature of being. I already kind of talked about dual reality and symbol dichotomy, marriage of opposition. So to get into the actual stuff of alchemy, as opposed to just the base way of having an alchemical worldview, alchemy is pretty much set up on three levels of creation. Most typically, you're going to see those three levels characterized in terms of salt, sulfur, and mercury, or the three principles. And we're going to talk about those in a second. But those are usually what you would look at in terms of defining the creation of a given thing. So, like, if I wanted to alchemically process Dustin here, then his body would be the salt. It's the actual physical element. And that salt contains the sulfur and the mercury. The mercury would be the spiritual substance of which his essential being is composed. And the sulfur, so his spirit, the sulfur would be all of the drive and sort of being that makes him him, as opposed to him something else. The spirit is essentially a universal substance. The soul, or the sulfur, is the actual spark or the motion or definition which cuts something away as a thing itself, as opposed to everything else. And so that's kind of alchemical creation within the microcosm. In a more macrocosmic view, you can look at creation going from the stars to the planets to the elements. And that's something that you'll see in some versions of ceremonial magic and occultism. But it's something that's often kind of left out and missed, because it gets into kind of the higher reaches of developing an initiatic system. But it's a much clearer component of the alchemical system, because really the alchemical system is the basis of a lot of the kind of ways in which we define our initiatic systems. One way that you can approach the three principles is as the existence working on that level of the stars. It's the essential nature of existence, the essential mythology of our creation and of our being, is this idea that we are composed of these three principles. And so you can equate the three principles entirely to the zodiac. And with that, you have the cardinal, fixed, and mutable signs. So each set of signs has within it the four elements. You have the planets represented throughout the signs. But overall, the signs are divided in that threefold manner. And that threefold manner is set up based on the three alchemical principles. The fixed signs relate to the concept of salt, the cardinal signs to the concept of sulfur, and the mutable signs to the concept of mercury. The way in which the stars, or the zodiac, functions along that idea of the initial base of creation is this concept that the sphere of the zodiac is towards that outer realm of the geocentric worldview. And so it's much closer to the original divine light. So the light that shines out from the fixed stars is a light which is fairly undifferentiated. It has its base concepts and base essential nature, but it's dealing with huge swaths of concepts and manifestations all at once. It's not something where you have things clearly defined down in until the light filters through other things. So in that sense, you're dealing with the highest level of being through the zodiac, or with the salt, sulfur, and mercury of a thing. From there, you move to the planets and the metals. Now, the relationship of the planets and the metals is one that I've always thought is really neat, because it's like a bridge. They're basically the Tiferet of alchemy. Tiferet being dual-natured, so that you have Tiferet on the one hand being the process of collecting all of the light of the tree above it and reflecting it down into the lower part of the tree, and also being the process of drawing all the light up from the low part of the tree and rocketing it forth into the upper part of the tree. It's like the gate that swings both ways. And then you can get into really metaphysical things with the inner and outer spheres of Tiferet, but that stops being alchemy. So with the planets and the metals, you have this same concept where they are essentially the same symbols, but the planets are kind of the heavenly version of those symbols, in which you're dealing with the creative influence of starlight. And the metals are the terrestrial version of those symbols, where you're dealing with the created base of starlight. So you have the same sevenfold division, and they match up to each other, but they're functioning in kind of a different way. It's the way in which heaven and earth marries to itself. And in getting to that idea of heaven and earth marrying, in alchemy, we use the Chaldean order of planets. You'll see some argument in the Kabbalah about whether or not to use the Chaldean order or to use certain other planetary orders. Like Kircher proposes a different planetary order for the way in which the planets follow on the tree of life. But the Chaldean, or the classical order, which goes Saturn to Jupiter to Mars to Sol to Venus, to Mercury, to Luna, to Earth, is the one that we find in alchemy. And this is incredibly important, especially when we juxtapose alchemy to the Kabbalah. Because in the Chaldean order, and you'll be at a little bit of a loss for this, not knowing as much about what the Tree of Life looks like, you have Mars, Sol, Venus. In the creation of the Philosopher's Stone, according to Isaac Newton, you have copper and iron, and you blend them together into an alloy that he refers to as the net. And what he's referring to, the net, in this case, is an alchemical reading of the myth of Hephaestus finding Venus and Mars entangled in an affair. And so he forges a net and captures them in the net. And Newton interpreted this as a way of recognizing how the metals go together in order to balance each other in order to create the perfect metal from which the stone could be created. The reason that iron and copper go together is because the traditional symbol for iron is a cross on top of a circle. And the traditional and still modern symbol for Venus is a circle surmounting a cross. So all of the metals and planets in alchemy are symbolized by combinations of crosses, circles, and crescents. When you have a circle, you're dealing with a solar metal. When you have a crescent, you're dealing with a lunar metal. So you're dealing with some combination of gold and the elemental nature, or some combination of silver and the elemental nature. The relationship of the cross to the circle or the crescent shows how the base metal or base planetary influence is interacting with the elements. And that the way in which the solarity or the lunarity of the material manifests through the elements defines the quality of the metal. So with Saturn, we have lead. So you have a cross completely on top of the moon. So all of the spiritual nature is being completely hidden and contained by the elemental nature. So the lowest level of manifestation has crushed and captured the spirit into this heavy, weighty, brittle, and breakable metal. In Mars, we have iron. So you have the elements crowning the sun. So instead of having an abundance of the influence of the soul, or that guiding internal light, you have the material influence taking hold. So it's stronger than lead because it has the solar presence instead of the soft lunar presence. But it's still a hard, dense, heavy metal because it's the sun trapped within the elements, or the idea of the spirit being, or the soul being removed from view in favor of the world. In soul, we just have the circle because all you have is the presence of the soul and celerity. You could essentially view this almost as if the elements are contained within the center of the circle. In Venus, or in copper, you have the sun surmounting the elements. So here you have an abundance of celerity. You have an intense presence of the spiritual, or the soul. And so that's why you have this fiery nature of copper, and copper is malleable and ductile and can be molded because the elemental firmness of it is not what's ruling in the case of copper.
Gold is more malleable, though.
What, you said gold is more, well, gold,
yeah,
is, gold has
sure
no
so.
Elemental
yeah.
presence. So, or the elemental presence is completely subsumed within the presence of the soul. With quicksilver, or mercury, you have a combination of the sun, the moon, and the elements, so that the union of the sun and the moon surmounts the elements. And so you have this dissolution of the elements and the soul within the spiritual presence. And so the metal is a fluid that mimics the nature of philosophical mercury, or the nature of the undefined sea of the spirit. Then for silver, you just have the crescent, because it's simply the manifestation of the moon. You could also view that as the crescent surmounting the cross, but in that case, the crescent would completely subsume the cross and just result in the presence of silver. If you go back to the center line along the Tree of Life, you have Mars, Sol, Venus. So you have the sun being overtaken by the elements being overtaken by the sun. If you turn them on their sides and link them together in the cross, which is the sign of the sun, they dissolve together into one, and you're left with simply the circle. And so the sun is revealed through the combination of iron and copper, or Mars and Venus, or OTO. And so there's the great secret of the OTO right there. So that's why the Chaldean order of planets is important for alchemy. You can look at a similar process across the other diagonal on the tree by looking at tin, gold, and mercury, but it doesn't work quite the same way. You'd almost be creating silver with that one instead of creating gold. But it's still the same concept of the two balanced elements of the elements, or the two balanced metals of the metals that are in opposition with one another, being set in opposition across the sphere of the sun. So that balancing that opposition in the nature of the metals results in that central position of celerity. Essentially, the symbols of silver and the moon and gold and the soul are gold and the sun are the symbols of sulfur and mercury. Silver represents mercury, and the essential nature of mercury is kind of almost this dark sea of being. It's Nuit in Thelema. It's the idea of kind of the universal undefined light from which everything stems. If you were to look at it in Genesis, it is the water upon which God speaks in order to create the earth. Sulfur, then, is the speaking, and so and is referred to sometimes as the voice of God upon the waters. It is the catalyst that stirs creation. And so it is, as mentioned earlier, the soul, the thing which drives the being on as a given individual thing. It's the true will that defines the nature, purpose, and direction of a given creation. It's the active principle. And so it's also the masculine, whereas the spirit or the mercury is the feminine. And so the marriage of the two is the marriage that creates manifestation and being. And the thing that's left after that is the salt, or the elements. As we said before, the way in which starlight moves through its given environments, or the way in which the essential essences combine with other essences and do so within given contexts, is what defines the way in which they manifest. And that's basically what's being dealt with within the sphere of the elements. And so the elements function as essentially the salt within alchemy. Now, in the original forms of alchemy, before Paracelsus, the elements were the be-all, end-all. You were basically dealing with this concept of the rotation of the elements, where you were moving materials through states, much like the physical states of modern chemistry, based on the elements, and that through moving them through those states, you were able to understand the essential nature of them. Within post-Paracelsian alchemy, we have a much more sort of Renaissance view of the elements, which in a lot of ways really is still the Greek view of Empedocles, and is kind of the view that's echoed in Agrippa, which makes sense because Agrippa and Paracelsus were both taught by Trithemius. So the elements are essentially the means of dividing phenomenon. In Ovid's Metamorphosis, it describes this in discussing chaos and how chaos is the unmitigated sort of status of the universe before there's any creation. All potential exists within chaos, but no actual thing exists within chaos. But in the stirrings of all this potential, these base concepts begin to form, And these concepts relate to kind of the ideas of expansion and contraction. And these expansions and contractions kind of butt up against each other until through their conflicting interaction, they begin creating manifest phenomenon. In Norse mythology, we see the same idea with the Sea of Fire and the Sea of Ice, as they kind of butt up against each other, and the sparks that come from them begin creating the first things within the universe. So there's this essential classical view of, I guess, small c classical there, that expansion and contraction are the base features of the universe, which is pretty thermodynamic, I guess. You have order and entropy, the idea that things are either going to coalesce together or they're going to be ripped apart, and that manifestation and being is essentially a result of the juxtaposition of this tugging things together and pulling things apart and balancing the two so that you don't have all of one or all of the other. If everything was drawn together in contraction, the universe would be one big block of solid, unmoving material. And if everything was blown apart in expansion, it would just be disparate particles moving everywhere all the time.
Well,
yes. But we're pretty disparate particles lumped together into neat, shiny, happy people. Just ask REM. So, the elements essentially then are a way of categorizing this expansion and contraction through the concepts of the moist and the dry and the warm and the cold. And so the elements are combinations of these features, and the way in which these features combine define whether or not it's expansive or contractive, and the way in which it expands or contracts. And the given nature of a thing is based on the way in which the elements compose that thing. Now, in Paracelsian alchemy, the elements are just defining the ground in which the thing manifests. Just like in Agrippan magic, the elements are just the place in which the celestial forces are manifesting. It's the same basic process between the two. The elements, being the salt, define a given type of vessel. The essence is fixed by connecting the sulfur to the mercury so that the volatile elements come together into a fixed element that can inhabit that vessel. And the way in which it manifests is based on the way in which the essence is fixed to one another, the type of essences that are fixing to one another, and the vessel in which they are being fixed. So in a sense, you have the stars as the alchemical mercury, the planets as the alchemical sulfur, and the elements as the alchemical salt. You have the general undefined light, the definition of that light, and the manifestation of that definition.
Say that again.
You have the general undefined light, the definition of that light, and then the manifestation of that definition. It's very much like the concept of the four worlds within the Kabbalah, except we're dealing with a threefold level. The Ruach kind of gets removed in alchemy because the alchemist functions as the Ruach. Ruach being the intellect. And,
it's the whole as above, so below thing.
Yes. And like any good system, the as above, so below also works as a up and down, across. So you have a horizon and a vertice. Yes. So, crosses. So, that's why I didn't say the whole thing. So that's pretty much it. I'm trying to think of a more alchemical way to steal Mark's friend Tom's line that he uses at the end of classes, but if you look at certain forms of alchemical thought, blowing one's wad is pretty alchemical. So so that actually took less time than I expected.
Okay.
That is. We could.
For about an hour.
Because we still
yes.
have to drive. Beth and I still have to drive all to Hell and Beyond.
Yes. I have to take little boys home. So.
I have to go and attend to my silly Rottweiler and all that.
Yes.
So.
So then I guess I won't talk about the Philosopher's Stone or the Elixir of Life. Yes.
Yeah, I would love to.
Yes. The, maybe when we eventually get to that, I will go into my whole theory of how you make the Philosopher's Stone out of pieces of people.
Cool.
Yes.
Whoa.
Because it's based... Kind of, yeah. It's based on a combination of Basil Valentinius and Paracelsus, because traditionally the view is that the Philosopher's Stone is the mineral stone. But if you look at what the Philosopher's Stone is supposed to do and you look at what the mineral stone does, they don't do the same thing. And the whole concept is a little ridiculous that the mineral stone would be the Philosopher's Stone when you think about what the Philosopher's Stone is. And Paracelsus also flat out says that the Philosopher's Stone is universal, therefore it cannot be created from any of the three kingdoms. So it has to be created from something else. And Valentinius talks about how it has to come from a living source, which is generative. And so that'll be the same bat time, same bat channel teaser for either the next class or the class after when we talk about. Yes. About the way the stone works.
So in the planned alchemy class, are you going to be discussing open and closed calcification? And
yes. Like in the planned alchemy class, we'll go through all of the actual processes as they are done in plant alchemy. I might bring in photographs. Originally, my plan was either to have us do an archaeus of water, like water alchemy, or to do a basic like distillation with plant alchemy. But setting up all the equipment for that would be a little intense, and it would take a really long time.
And I bet you don't have all day Monday to do that.
No.
I'll do a distillation apparatus from my lab.
That would be fun.
I could break up the stuff in my house. I'm sure Gordon would share nicely.
So we'll talk about spagyric processes instead of alchemical processes, and we'll discuss how the alchemical processes work next to the spagyric processes. And then you'll have the basic knowledge you would need to go home and do it. And then eventually when I get my shed lab set up, maybe I'll let people come over and see.
I don't know what's going to happen then.
Or maybe not.
Just like Jack Parsons.
Just as long as I do it after I teach the Parsons class, right?
Yeah. Yes. If you teach the Parsons class, you have to get ordained first.
And the Parsons class comes before the ordination.
I know. So you have to get ordained first.
And then I can blow up. Okay.
Don't fuck up my ordination.
So
in other words, a fire extinguisher would be a really good ordination gift.
Yes, yes.
There's one in the fire altar. That's good.
So don't pull a L. Ron Hubbard and blow me up. Should I talk about L. Ron on the recording, or should I stop the recording?